Alright, let's get started. Let me welcome everybody for this particular event. It's noon. Thank you for coming. Thank you to the Commodity Club. Nicholas is here to close the session later on for co-sponsoring this event. I want to thank John very much, of course, our star for today, for making himself available, and Michael for arranging everything and having the idea, and Michael will also introduce John and then moderate the discussion. I guess we should start immediately, given that we basically have to conclude at about 1 o'clock. I should say, perhaps, also that I'm the executive director of the Molecular Center here at London University, which is a joint center between the law school and the Earth Institute. And Lisa, is she still here?
Yes. Is
the assistant director of the center, and Perrine is here as well, working on issues related to extractive industries, and this is actually an event that has to do with extractive industries. So, Mike.
Great. Thank you, Carl, and I want to thank the Vale Center, and thank John Graham as well. I want to say a little bit about, by way of background, a little bit about what issue, some of the issues we're trying to address today, and introduce John in the process, because he's been central to these issues. When most of the time when I'm at the Columbian, we're talking about extractives, we're talking about outward investments into extractives industries by U.S. firms, and we'll talk about that a little bit today, but increasingly the big challenge for the U.S. is how to deal with two core issues in extractives. One is foreign inward investment into our extractive sectors, as well as the issue of how to deal with what is a large regional variation in the country in receptivity to extractives investment versus the when one compares the North and the South. But at its core is this question of, can the U.S. grow at emerging market rates if it doesn't open up its extractives, rich resources, particularly in the midst of a commodity boom? So we're in a commodity boom, and the U.S. is investing abroad and not investing domestically and is dependent upon all sorts of politics abroad. So John's formerly head of Shell North America and then and now Citizens for Affordable Energy, and also central to many of these discussions. And one of the things that, as you'll see today, that's a signature about John's approach is that we're going to get actually to some of the real issues and real challenges rather than the politics and the politicking around this specific issue. And John regularly is, I guess, what, a couple of years ahead of where we're likely to have our political crises. So by getting at some of these underlying issues, we're going to know, have some sort of idea of the election cycle and post-election cycle as well. And so I will turn it over to John to talk, and then we'll have a discussion.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. Can you hear me all right at the end?
Good. Great.
The next 10 years, I would suggest, may be the most important 10 years of your lives. Because of what you're doing here, because of the preparation that you are experiencing, and because the world that you are going to take over in the subsequent period, once you've had that 10 years of experience in today's world, the real question is, what will that world be like, and will you be prepared for it? I give a lot of talk to people your age. I'm on the faculty of the Global Institute of Sustainability at Arizona State University, where I teach once a week. And it is the next generation who are experiencing what I would say is the end of the 20th century and the beginning of a new century in a political world and a political process that doesn't have a clue where it's going or how it's going to get there. We have allowed ourselves, and I'll just speak to this country for a moment, but we have allowed ourselves, through the benefits of the 20th century, to basically believe that we're taken care of. But guess what? We're not. The 20th century did a lot to create jobs, to build wealth, to create value across all kinds of industries, and to support this country with the world's most robust, the world's most effective energy system that gave the Americans the lifestyle that the rest of the world would love to have. And it was that energy system investment from the 19-teens up through the 1970s that created this incredible energy system, which was the lubricant of the whole rest of the economy. Think about what happened because we had electricity at affordable rates. Think about what happened because we had liquid fuel at affordable rates. This nation became the world's greatest economy with the world's most envied lifestyle. We also discovered in the 1970s that there were environmental consequences for the energy system that we built. And we began a process of challenging the environmental implications of that energy system, which we continue to deal with today. But something has gone awry. Something is very dangerous in today's outlook and prospects for the energy system of tomorrow. And that is, the existing energy system is so old, so tired, so lacking in reinvestment as to put this nation at risk, particularly in the densest, most populous parts of the country, where since the 1970s we have all but stopped new infrastructure investment of any magnitude. Example, and I'm giving you facts here, not politics. Example, 600 coal plants in this country, average age 40 years old, design life of 50. If the average age is 40, you can imagine how many 60, 70, and 80-year-old plants we have out there that really need to be decommissioned because they're past their design life. And they're just held together, I say metaphorically, with paper clips and Band-Aids. 104 nuclear plants. We haven't built a new one in 30 years, which means the average age of our nuclear fleet is right around 30 years with a design life of 40. Or a permitted life of 40. Now some 60 of those 40-year permits have been renewed for another 20 years. So if you have any concerns about nuclear energy and old plants, instead of communities living surrounding 40-year-old plants, they're going to be living surrounding 60-year-old plants. And the design life was originally 40 years. So that's the electrical system. We haven't built a new dam in this country in 30, 40 years for hydropower. And there's unlikely to be any new big dams built in this country. We've been frittering with wind and solar for 30 years and have made no progress that's material in terms of the quantity of electricity produced. Wind and solar continue to be frittered with because we're not serious about it. If we were serious, we wouldn't be talking 100 turbine wind farms. That's just, you know, such a small amount of electricity to supply the nation, or 100, you know, megawatt solar farms. That's like a tiny coal plant, which only supports a small community of a few thousand people. If we were serious about wind and solar, everything we're doing should be multiplied by a factor of 10. So instead of 100 wind turbines on a wind farm, it should be 1,000. Now, guess what would happen if somebody proposed a 1,000 turbine wind farm? The land use issues and the landowners would say, oh my God, 1,000 wind turbines? They take 30 acres each. So you're talking huge land usage. And if you're talking solar, they also take huge acreage. So it's not an easy thing to say existing investments times 10, because there are factors. So instead of making any progress, we defer decisions. And the system gets older and older and older. We use 20 million barrels of oil a day in this country. Whether you like oil, you don't like oil, the fact is we use 20 million barrels a day of to quantify that, that's 10,000 gallons every second. That's a lot. That's a tank truck full of oil every second of every minute of every hour of every day of every week. We produce 7 in this country. We import 13. We used to produce 10, but over the course of the last 30 years, our domestic production has declined to about 7 million barrels. 49% of every electron that comes through our light bulbs, our server farms, our motors, our street lights, our traffic lights, 49% of all those electrons come from coal. About 22% come from natural gas. About 19% come from nuclear, and about 5% from hydropower. You add those numbers up, you're at roughly 98% of every electron that we use every day comes from traditional energy. That is the 20th century infrastructure. We can talk about renewables, that's fine. I've invested a lot personally in renewables in my former position as president of Shell. No return on investment, but you know, these are long-term investments where the technology is not yet robust. Didn't expect to make money, but wanted to test what works and what doesn't work. So the point I'm making is we are dependent entirely on traditional energy to keep the lights on. And while there are a lot of people who want to turn against the traditional sources of energy, realistically, for years and years and years to come, it's what we're going to have to rely on because we don't have really a serious alternative. Now, we're worried about the economy, right? And that's why I say the next 10 years are so important to you, because you will enter the economy in one way or another over the course of this decade. What kind of an economy will you enter, and how challenging will it be? Well, if we stay on the course we're on, it will be extremely challenging. 9% unemployment, interest rates near zero, an aversion to any kind of further deficit spending that might stimulate the economy, and the withholding of private capital because of concerns, doubts, or worries whether there would be a decent return on that capital given lackluster demand, has put us in the doldrums. Self-made. Self-made doldrums. Are we going to stay there? Well, let me just flip to the other side of the world for a moment to give you a sense of a country that has a little different outlook on the economy. These facts come from Professor Wenren Jiang of the University of Alberta. And he is very well connected with the ministries of China, so his data is primary data directly from China, not from press reports or from other third-party sources, but direct sources. Between now and 2020, the plans in China call for the building of 5 million kilometers of highway. What do you do with 5 million kilometers of highway? You fill it up with cars and trucks and buses, just like we did when we built the interstate highway system in this country. There are plans for 170 new mass transit systems in cities where they currently lack mass transit. How many new mass transit systems are being built in this country today? You can't find one. You can find some extensions in a few cities, but I believe Phoenix was the last city to put in a mass transit system in the last decade, which is a single line rail, light rail that runs about 10 miles. China, 170 mass transit system. 5 million new buildings will be built in China over the course of the next 10 years, occupying some 40 billion square meters of building space. What do you do with building space? 40 million square meters worth, billion square meters worth. You light it, you heat it, you cool it. They expect 165 million tourists a year in China by 2020. How do you get to China? You fly. They expect more than 65 million Chinese to visit around the world by 2020. How do they get out of China? They fly. Everything I'm describing, ladies and gentlemen, is energy intensity increasing at near double-digit growth rates in China, leading to the current activities that are going on, the commissioning of a coal-powered power plant roughly every week to 10 days, the building out of large-scale wind and solar systems to where China is now number one in the world in wind and solar production of energy, the building of 34 nuclear plants over the next decade, we're building zero, the building out of pipelines, natural gas extraction, and on and on and on. Because economic development is job one in China, as everyone knows, and the energy to support that investment in the economy is what it's going to take for that economy to operate. So come back now to the United States. We put 100 new coal plants on the shelf in the last 5 years. We're not building any new nuclear plants. And I described already how old our system is. Here's the point. If we simply committed ourselves to replacing plants that are at or past their design life, if we committed ourselves as a country to extracting the oil and natural gas that put us back to the production level in this country of the 1970s and 1980s of 10 million barrels a day instead of 7, we would be building about 50 nuclear plants. We would be building about 100 to 150 coal plants. We would be building, because of the natural gas resources that we have discovered or developed over the last 5 to 6 years, another 50 to 60 or more gas plants, to be able to take the dirtiest coal plants offline, to be able to retire the aging nuclear infrastructure that we have. We're talking about capital investment in the range of between $2 and $3 trillion over the next decade. $2 to $3 trillion of capital investment in the oil and natural gas we know we're going to need, rather than import it. We don't have an alternative transportation system in this country. And what we do is when we need more, we import more. Why do we import more when we could produce more? We may not like coal, but coal can be cleaned up significantly beyond what an 80-year-old power plant puts out. Coal gasification with carbon capture and sequestration is a technology being developed and used in other countries. We only talk about it, and we naysay it before we've ever tried it. The $2 to $3 trillion investment has a multiplier. Econ 101. The multiplier could be at least a factor of 3. So here we are, a $14 trillion economy. And if we would address the energy reinvestment that this nation needs to keep the lights on, to keep fuel in our vehicles, to keep the airplanes in the sky, through domestic production instead of foreign production, that $2 to $3 trillion capital investment becomes anywhere between $6 to $9 trillion on top of the $14 trillion economy. Do the math. That's $2 to $3 trillion a year over just the next, well, I said 10 years. So that's about $1 trillion on top of 14. What is that as a percent of growth? That's about a 7% growth rate. We haven't seen 7% growth in this country in decades. What would 7% growth mean to jobs, to careers, to lifestyle choices, to building or rebuilding a tired country? What would that do to economic security? What would that do to revenues to the federal government and state government that are in such deficit positions? A rising tide lifts all ships. What this nation needs is an economic investment. And I'm so pleased that the Bali Columbia Center on Sustainable International Investment and the Commodity Club invited me to come here to talk about this. The more people I can talk to about the economic opportunity that this country faces, the more people might get excited. And in a country where every person has the vote, guess who runs the country? Not the sorry lot that can't agree on anything in the interest of the nation. but rather the people of the nation who actually live their lives in this nation. And that's where I spend my time. I'll stop with one more point, and then maybe we can open it up. The flaw in our system when it comes to energy future is the fact that we have so many people governing it, nobody governs it. Just at the federal level, 13 cabinet departments govern energy. At the legislative level, 26 congressional committees, Senate and House, govern energy. And every federal judge and every district court can govern energy based on a case brought to that bench that affects energy policy. When you have that many governing entities governing, nobody's governed. And the industry doesn't care. The industry has been and will continue to be fragmented because it's designed to be fragmented because the technologies are all so different. And everyone's competing in their space so that they can do well in their own space. They're not allowed to cooperate. That would be violating any trust laws. So they do what they do. And they learned how to make money a long time ago with the way the system is. So my bottom line, my ultimate bottom line, is we will not have an energy future in this country under the current governance. And I haven't talked about states. I've just talked to federal so far. What I propose to fix the governance, and I wrote about this in a book called Why We Hate the Oil Company, Straight Talk from an Energy Insider, I propose the creation through law of an independent regulatory commission that does for the energy sector what the Fed does for the financial sector. An independent regulatory commission to move past the partisan politics of the day, to move past the confused and dysfunctional over-governance that takes place under today's system and structure, and moves past the politics of the White House so that things can be done over a long-term basis, not just a two-year, four-year electoral cycle basis. We could go into a lot more depth on that, but I'd rather get into discussion with you. But if we don't change the governance of energy, you will enter, over the course of this decade, an economy and an energy system that is even more tired, more close to broken, and you could well find yourselves deciding not to live in certain parts of the country because of persistent blackouts, brownouts, and gas lines. Because an energy abyss is on its way before this decade is out, where the old system just can't keep up what people demand every day. When you think about the inward investment, the FDI that's associated with this kind of a $2 to $3 trillion capital investment, Katie, bar the door. Funds from around the world will see the U.S. economy as the place to be. Companies in this country will see the U.S. economy as the place to be. And if you could look at a U.S. economy, the biggest in the world, significantly larger than the Chinese economy for at least the next decade if we do things smart, we're looking at growth rates unprecedented in the last 30, 40 years for the world's largest economy, and all you can say is, wow. When it comes to jobs, economic futures, and the prosperity that goes a long way to addressing all the other problems we face. Thanks for listening.
Maybe what I'll do is throw out a few general questions and then open it up for people to answer. I'll just in terms of framing things. One question is, if the U.S. has to achieve this rates of growth, can the U.S. achieve this rates of growth without this sort of energy, domestic energy investment? Right? So that's one question I'd ask. Another question is, can you think of any, for those of you who study export-led growth and FDI-driven growth, can you think of any country that has succeeded quickly that hasn't done this and hasn't associated with some degree of centralization of power, particularly when the U.S. has 50 states, several hundred cities and towns, right? So is that an insurmountable challenge? And then just the third thing to point out is that if the U.S., if most of the goods that we use in the U.S. are depend upon primary commodities, extractives, or energy of some sort, then And the strength of the U.S. economy now during the crisis has been its foreign direct investment abroad into these sectors through its financial institutions and its large firms. What's the option that the U.S. has in terms of supplying the energy and the basic commodity needs when it starts to, if it's going to achieve its aspirations of turning into an export-led growth? So I just sort of throw that out, but open up to questions.
Hi. I agree with you on, my name's Evan Perrigo. I agree with you on some of your points. You know, we need more investment in things like nuclear, mass transit. But as lawyers, we're thinking about kind of a regulatory approach here. And so I put two proposals to you. First, it seems like a lot of the reason we have a lot of old, especially coal plants, is that the way that the Environmental Protection Agency's new source review is set up, which is if you've got an old pre-Environmental Protection Act plant, you don't have to comply unless you make major changes. So it's we get instances of, well, let's, you know, if you change the handle on the axe and leave the head, is it the same axe? And then if you change the head, is it still the same axe? Where we have these kind of incremental changes happening. And so if we kind of extended emissions regulations back to existing plants, wouldn't that provide an incentive to, you know, stop keeping these old plants in operation and build something new? And the other seems to be, if we want to kind of upset the apple cart, as it were, and get some reinvestment in the energy sector happening, wouldn't a good policy be actually a carbon tax that makes such old plants no longer profitable so that energy companies decide, you know, I'm going to go build a nuclear plant?
The answer to both your questions is yes. And to take it a step further, because that's a rather simplified answer, the new source review has really kept a lot of old plants going, no question about it, because it's cheaper to keep the old one fired up than to go through. But where herein lies the real issue, I don't blame the utilities, I don't blame the EPA. The public utility commissions chartered across 50 states in this country are chartered with a 1930s chartering mindset, which is lowest possible rates to the consumer. So if you're a public utility commission determining the rates that ratepayers will pay, despite what the utilities might request they pay, and you're chartered by your state legislature to support lowest possible rates, guess what? That's what you do. And so we are really hung up by an outdated public utility mindset that doesn't enable. I've talked to Mike Morris at AEP, big power company, Jim Rogers at Duke. Jim and Mike and me and several others formed an organization called United States Climate Action Partnership. We drafted a cap and trade legislation for the Congress and the 111th Congress. It became known as the Waxman-Markey bill. By the time Waxman and Markey and their cohorts got done with it, nobody from USCAP would support it. It completely obliterated the opportunity for a balanced industry cap-and-trade system, which would enable from coal plants to refineries to aluminum plants to steel mills to have a fair shot at the future. In order to buy votes to get the bill passed, they completely skewered any source of carbon that wasn't coal. And so anybody but the coal industry walked away from it because all the credits were given to coal. And, you know, I said to Waxman, I said to Markey, as soon as the bill was passed, Ed, we got to move to Plan B. This is a disaster. I said, well, we just passed it. I said, the Senate won't touch it. It's so skewered from what was the original framework that USCAP worked on for 3 years. You guys worked on it for 3 months. We spent 3 years. So we were a bit frustrated, pardon my emotive reaction here. But I still am a cap and trader because companies can make money trading carbon credits, and the winners will take their profits and put new investments, cleaner investments, and the losers will go out of business if they don't participate. And so I still think that's a solution. But, of course, it's the DOA at the current time. So I think that we can. I'm a big believer because I've seen the technology in action in Europe and in Australia and in China. coal gasification with carbon capture and sequestration means we can have a coal industry. But the public utility commissions have to grant the Mike Morrises and the Jim Rogers of the world the rate relief to pay for it. And I argue in my book that over a 30-year period, it's cheaper. Higher capital costs, but far more efficient use of the fuel, and the credits you get from taking the carbon out of the atmosphere if we had a cap and trade bill. Win, win, win. Cheaper, actually cheaper to the ratepayer once they've paid the initial capital investment, better for the environment, better for the economy.
Thank you very much. This is a fascinating discussion. I am curious. I know you've talked a lot here about coal and natural gas. So I don't know the extent to which you're also talking about oil. But I'm curious about our long-term capacity to maintain these greater outputs. You mentioned that at one point we were producing domestically 7 million or 10 million barrels of oil, and now it's gone down to 7. And I'm wondering what the reason for that is and whether we're going to face increasing costs of extraction. Like, you know, we've heard a lot about the extraction in Alaska being really expensive and et cetera. Is the cost of extraction going to go up significantly enough that this is really not a long-term solution? And how many resources do we have to maintain this kind of growth over the long term?
If we just look at the Western Hemisphere, which is the Americas, nearly untouched in terms of oil reserves are the oil sands of Athabasca, with about a trillion barrels, probably half, 500 billion could be recoverable. A trillion barrels in Colorado and the Piance Basin, oil shale it's called, which is oil locked in rock, so it's solid molecules that would have to be liquefied. And the Orinoco Basin in Venezuela, a trillion barrels of what's called heavy oil. So the 3 trillion barrels of reserves just in this hemisphere are developable at today's prices over a long period of time. But getting the permits and getting the support to make that happen is very problematic. The Orinoco Basin, it's controlled by the Chavez regime. Nobody trusts the Chavez regime, so nobody's going to put good money after bad because he appropriated all of these properties that private companies had in Venezuela. In the case of the Piance Basin, huge resistance from the Congress to the state of Colorado to all kinds of NGOs and associations. I've been out there many times, and when you stand on top of a trillion barrels of oil and you can't touch it, it's like taking a kid to a candy store and saying, doesn't this look pretty, but you can't have any. Athabasca is being developed because the national government of Canada said, despite the criticism, we're going to do this in the interest of the nation, the sovereign interest of the nation, and we will compel the oil companies to make it cleaner, which is exactly what's happening. So they've moved the technology to something that is a steam-assisted development process, so you don't have the big mining excavations the way you used to. That's not finished yet, but mining will phase out. The upgrading and the water wastes of taking the oil off the sand, that will phase out. They already have photos of recovered lands that look just like normal bog. It can be restored. Australia restores coal mines. West Virginia restores coal mines. So we can do a lot sustainably, I believe, but we have to overcome the ignorance that leads to resistance or the ideological bias which leads to resistance if we think about what's good for the nation, what's good for the economy. But I do believe there should be sustainability factors in everything we do.
So it's certainly just to frame it into some of the international questions. So this is the development trade-off, right, that the U.S. is facing. The growth on the one hand, versus some of the constraints on growth that are political, that are environmental movements, these sorts of things, right? Often state and federal political. So it's nothing so different than what most countries face on that front. The U.S. has a much harder time in facing it because the U.S. has a very strong institutional basis for resisting these things that most countries facing development trade-offs don't have. But just to mention the job tie-in a little bit to this, you're saying, so in Youngstown, Ohio, when shales are beginning to be dealt, B&M, you know, just located a factory to do the pipelines, right? So foreign direct investment manufacturing comes in proximity to oil extraction, natural gas extraction, because it's location advantage, right? So it's one, if something has to be produced close to the marketplace, in these, then it means the jobs are going to be close. You don't have to put in special provisions. If you want to have piping that's going to feed into the natural gas system, you're going to do the piping nearby. And so it's a, so one of the broader questions is, before we open to questions, where, what's the stimulus question here, right? So are we, this is this question that the country's facing, which is, what's a targeted stimulus? So when you raise, some of this stuff can be done without money, right? So what should we be doing with money, and what should we be doing without money? And I think that that's the central question that we're starting to get, that we've been getting at today, that is the central question the country has to deal with, but we don't deal with in our politics, both the need for energy in order to achieve growth rates, and whether we have an appetite for growth and jobs in the country, which we may in certain quarters not have as much, or whether and where to spend our money.
Two things happened in the 20th century that led us down the path that we took with respect to the energy infrastructure. One was the Rural Electrification Act of the 1930s, which required, which granted every citizen an entitlement to be on the grid, regardless of where they live. That took the electricity sourcing all over the nation. The second was the Interstate Highway Act of the 1950s, which created that huge infrastructure, which took the nation in enormous directions. So earlier, I think you mentioned how much power is centralized to make these things happen. Well, the federal government, in periods of FDR and Dwight Eisenhower, made very powerful central decisions, allowed states to administer it, so states' rights were protected, but we built this national grid, this national infrastructure of highway, because of those two central bills.
And we did it with FDI. So railroads were built with FDI in this country, and Wall Street was just a little people made under the tree downtown, right? So all the law firms and banks grew up around the railroad infrastructure and then started to bundle the money. And then that's how they started to rise in prominence, so even the banking.
Yes.
Well, I certainly would agree with your starting point, a number of your starting points about the need for spending large amounts of government revenues as well as private revenues on infrastructure developments in the United States in order to build a 21st century infrastructure instead of a early 20th to mid 20th century infrastructure. And the idea of a national federal regulatory commission, a central, one central entity that would be responsible for the aspects of energy policy is certainly an intriguing one.
Also, if I may, modeled on the Fed, which has regional banks
right.
as well.
Right.
So I can see regional federal energy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a huge problem caused by the fact that we have 50 different regulatory commissions in addition
right.
to the 13 federal departments that you mentioned and the 26 congressional committees. It would be one way to try to overcome the fragmentation of the system. Where I would take issue, though, is with your emphasis on the need, and perhaps I'm not hearing you properly, but your emphasis on coal as a solution. Because I think that when you look at the life cycle costs of coal and the externalities of coal production and use and how much of the energy that's in a lump of coal that actually gets translated into the light, well, these aren't incandescent, but into a light bulb, which is very, very small. It's, I believe, less than 10%. It's somewhere in the order of 3% actually. That coal in itself is very inefficient and very costly as a source of power. And I think that I would emphasize more the tremendous potential that there are from other renewable energy sources, including wind and solar, because I think that we're just beginning to see the potential there. For example, when you talk about the problem of wind farms, and I will grant that it is a real problem and a real issue, and that there is no way that we can build wind farms right now on the scale that's required, at least on land. However, there is more and more development of offshore wind farms that we're seeing, and also the possibility of other things such as higher altitude wind farms, where there's actually more stable flow of wind, and I've seen proposals regarding technology for that. And it's very possible to develop that kind of technology, for example. So I think that we're only just beginning, and despite our meager investment in alternative energy, and I'm not talking about Shell's, because actually I happen to know that Shell has been a major supporter of alternative and renewable energy, that if we put more of our resources into developing these technologies, into the research and development, and into the support for early stage companies and VC, and despite the scandal over Solyndra, there is a tremendous need for that kind of support. And yes, people have to learn that, yeah, there are going to be things that don't work and that lose money. And on the other hand, there are going to be things that work really well and will make a lot of money and generate a lot of jobs. And you have to go through a process of elimination and experimentation before you know what the dominant paradigm is going to be and what the dominant energy source is going to be.
Right. What it calls for is an energy plan that has a 50-year time horizon. Because 50 years in energy time is about the life of a major facility. And so the reason I advocate more coal now, and more natural gas now, and more nuclear now, is over a 50-year time frame, we can't ramp up, in my view, the alternatives to traditional energy at a fast enough pace to other than have shortages. And I don't think the populace would tolerate shortages for very long, not after we just had the storm come through the Northeast and knock out power for a couple weeks. People can't live that way. And so with a plan where the short term is 0 to 10 years, the medium term 10 to 25 years, and the long term 25 to 50 years, you have plants that come in and go out in that 50-year time period using traditional energy while you are working on the nanotechnology necessary to have solar efficiency in the mid to high 30s or 40s percent range, because 8% today is not going to compete with coal. And we aren't past the double digits yet with the best solar technologies that we have out in the field. And so we've got a lot of work to do that's going to take not years but decades, I'm afraid. So it's a graduated process that has a here and a now, a then, and a then a later. And so I think that's the kind of thinking we have to go through. Yes?
Yeah, I haven't heard you speak at all about demand side management and energy efficiency measures. What role do you think they play?
A very important role in several dimensions. From a transmission of electricity standpoint and from a local production standpoint, there's a lot more that could be done with an intelligent grid and distributed generation, capturing a lot of the waste heat that we currently just throw into the atmosphere. I think that one of the planks of my foundation is technology for efficiency. So the technology for efficiency looks like, to me, getting rid of the internal combustion engine once and for all. Because the internal combustion engine is 20% efficient, 100 years old, and for every $100 you spend on gasoline, $80, you may as well light a match to it. Because only $20 of your $100 spend gives you what I call go juice, mobility. It's a waste. It's a machine. It ought to be replaced. And I'm an advocate of hydrogen fuel cell technology and battery technology and mass transit, as a matter of fact. And so those three, which China's doing. You know, we've been zigzagging in our support for alternatives to the internal combustion engine for a long time, but we got to get rid of it. But it'll take 25, 30 years to do that. And I'm an advocate of other kinds of technology for efficiency as well, which time doesn't permit.
Don't you think there's some accountability issues if you have a centralized regulatory body? For example, currently quite a few economists blame the Fed for causing the booms and busts, from the left and from the right. And what you're basically asking for is, again, get an unaccountable body which has its own mandate and which is going to eventually have the people staffing that will come from the energy companies, and you don't know what their incentives are.
Yeah, I encourage you to read my chapter on the idea in my book, because it goes into more depth than I can do in a few minutes here. But I agree that the Fed has been imperfect. But would you rather have Congress?
I'd rather have no
so
one.
Congress is incapable. I mean, Congress proves repeatedly their incapability of making hard choices. The Fed at least will make hard choices. Sometimes they make bad choices.
Bad hard choices.
And they made bad choices when Greenspan didn't, and his board of directors did not start to tighten up loose money, and Bernanke kept feeding the problem. They didn't see it coming. They trusted other agencies. They trusted that a AAA bond was a AAA bond, only it was junk. And so the whole system fell apart, not just the Fed.
Exactly
the
my
Fed
point.
So it, but then who corrected it? The Fed corrected it. The Fed is self-correcting. Wow. Same thing happened in the 30s. The Fed self-corrected. When they tightened up the money supply, they realized they went too far, then they loosened it up. So it's not perfect. There's no perfect institution I can imagine, or we would have found it by now. But it's got to be better than what we've got.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. So if you think about this in any other country that's facing the same types of problems, you have all the export credit agencies, right? The Export-Import Bank, the Japan Bank, across the border. You have a World Bank, you have an Inter-American Bank, you've got the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, you've got the International Finance Corporation. Every country has a screening agency that in part screens investment and also drives investment decisions internally. Every country has usually some sort of plan, to outline perspective plan for 5, 10 years down the line, something 20 years down the line. I would say that nothing would function in any other country without that set of institutions. We have none of them, right? So that's part of the problem as well, is that we have no, it's not that we have a centralization of power. Part of it is that we have a centralization of power issue, but part of it is also that we have none of the institutions that everybody else relies upon in order to bring private capital into these sorts of projects. And it takes, and we know from 20, 30 years of experience with private-driven, public-private partnership, that's been a lot of mistakes. It takes time to make these things run well, too. They run a lot better now than they did before. The World Bank looks nothing like it did after the Second World War. But part of the basic question that I think that John's getting at through his talk and through this is that after the Second World War, we didn't say we're going to do the Marshall Plan for 10 or 20 years from now, right? And if we had said we're going to do the Marshall Plan for 10 or 20 years from now, we would have done different things. But the need was immediate. So the institutional mobilization for foreign capital and for the banks, the law firms, and the international institutions was quick. And part of the issue that the U.S. faces comparatively is that we don't have that mobilization, ability to mobilize energy and to do these things. And whether it's through this sort of proposal that's a centralized institution or some other, we lack that ability to do what most other places have pre-baked institutions to help them do.
I'd like to understand the calculus behind getting to 7% GDP growth just a little bit better. I mean, point in time today, known economic reserves, recent discoveries in 2B undermine the peak oil thesis. So the specific infrastructure and industry projects that you propose to help get there, are those midstream projects? Do you see us going upstream in our parks today? And can you speak to the sustainability of the labor that would be employed in those projects?
I think it would be a combination of many. So it's the upstream, it's the midstream, it's the downstream. Because everything's so old that's out there. It's unsafe. And then the next decade will be even more unsafe. And so Matt Simmons, who passed away a year ago, author of Peak Oil Theory, said that the existing infrastructure needs a $15 trillion facelift to bring it back to its original standard. That's not going to happen. Let's replace it. So if you're looking upstream, midstream, and downstream, just in the case of 3 million barrels of oil to go from 7 to 10, you're looking at roughly $1 trillion over a period of about 10 years, creating 3 million jobs, taking into account the multiplier, so it's 1 million production jobs plus the 2 million steel workers, iron ore miners, car manufacturers, truck manufacturers, house builders, all the kinds of multiplier that would occur. But from a sustainability of the workplace, these are not just temporary, let's build a bridge. Let's replace a bridge, because this all has to be sustained. This is infrastructure that once built is sustained over time with employees, but that multiplier keeps riveting through the economy. So the sons and daughters of the drillers and the steel makers and so forth will go off and do other things. I happen to believe that biotech and other kinds of electronic development in the next 20 to 30 years will take us even further into the richness that we've created in this economy. But right now we have this, I think, for the next 50 years, and it would take that long, to build an infrastructure that we can hand over proudly for the 22nd century is a critical requirement, and we're ignoring it. And it can include highways and bridges and sewer plants and water plants and so forth, because they're all old too. When I come to New York, this is the land of Robert Moses. It still is. He's been dead 50 years. But when you see the highways and the bridges and the tunnels and everything, that's Robert Moses.
And apropos your point, why is Stephen Chu?